It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window, the podcast that brings you the news before it becomes news. And as you know, we also give you insight and analysis on all the topics you're talking about in football. I mean, McGarry, and always with me, Duncan Castles. It's your questions answered this Wednesday's podcast. However, we are going to start with some news. And of course, it concerns our old friend, Valerie. Yes, VAR is making waves even when there's no games on. We have learned, the transfer window that is, that there is a potential revolt on the horizon for Mike Riley and the PGMOL. Riley is due to address the Premier League stakeholders, i.e. every club in the Premier League, at a routine meeting in London on Thursday of this week, in which he will be requested to give assurances that either they can fix the inconsistencies and controversy over VAR regarding the first 12 weeks of the Premier League season, the first 12 rounds of games. And we understand that if he cannot or does not give correct information, or indeed allows there to be a sense of agreement amongst the 20 clubs, then it's possible a motion will be tabled at that meeting that VAR be suspended, potentially for the rest of this season, in order to give the authorities an opportunity to get it right when, of course, we all know they've been getting most of it wrong. This would be an incredible and also an unprecedented move by the Premier League clubs. But Duncan, the fact of the matter is that VAR is not something which is a necessity. It is a voluntary sign up from Premier League to take it on board. Therefore, the idea that it might in some way compromise the integrity of the competition, which has taken place so far with VAR included, is not going to be an issue. You've heard as well, Duncan, I understand that referees, as in the elite referees, are also unhappy with the way that VAR is being implemented and the way that they, as a group, are looking to the public and supporters, broadcasters alike, in terms of being made to look either indecisive or foolish.
Yes, I think you're getting the chickens coming home to roost here with VAR. You know, we've predicted on the transfer window for a long time that this was going to be a mistake. It was going to lower the quality of football, that fans would not appreciate it once it was in place, that it would not be well received by managers, would not be well received by players. And I think now you're seeing that it's not being well received by the referees. And that's where Mike Riley, as the senior referee in England, is in a very difficult position. Understand that Riley addressed referees this week and told them, the quote I've seen is that he said to them, "I'm well pleased with the way VAR is operating." This happening in the same week as we've seen Neil Swarbrick, who is a former Premier League referee who's been placed in charge of the implementation of VAR by Mike Riley, go to BBC and other broadcasters and say he is well pleased, effectively, with how VAR started, giving himself a mark of 7-ish out of 10 and saying they expected these kind of issues and all will be resolved down the line, and they will get VAR not only to be 7 out of 10 but to be 10 out of 10, I guess, is what he is promising and what Riley is promising. That I think he has a major issue here, because once you have the referees feeling that they're being undermined and embarrassed by a system that's supposed to help them, supposed to assist them, you have a major issue. I think it's important to note that earlier this month, Keith Hackett, who is one of Riley's predecessors as the head of PGMOL, wrote a very strongly worded column for the Daily Telegraph, the headline of which was "Sack Mike Riley and Stop Treating Match-Going Fans Like Dirt." So you have a former head referee being extremely explicit in his criticism of the man who's in charge of referees now. He talked about how standards had dropped hugely under Riley's reign, which honestly, I don't think you can argue with him on that. I think the standard of refereeing has dropped in recent years, even before VAR came in, and that it was time for a change to the man in charge. And he recommended that the Premier League, as the best league in the world, should go out and secure the best head of referees, and suggested that they should try and get Pierluigi Collina to take over that role for them. I am sure that Hackett did not write that piece without consulting current referees in the Premier League. So he will have had a sense of the way a revolt is building against Riley. So if you look at it from this perspective, Riley has his own referees unhappy with the implementation of VAR, which Riley is still defending and saying is going well. And he has Swarbrick defending and saying going well. You now also have Premier League clubs going into this meeting this week wanting to hear that matters are going to change, and considering a motion to have VAR suspended for the rest of the season. Why are the Premier League clubs, some Premier League clubs, thinking this way? I think it's very obvious why. It's damaging the product. The owners of football clubs in the main in the Premier League are there for financial purposes. They've bought assets, a number of them, and some of the most significant of them have those assets with a view to selling them down the line for significant profit. Manchester United being one example, Liverpool being another, Tottenham Hotspur, another prominent example. You have Roman Abramovich testing the market to sell clubs. So this kind of long period in which Premier League revenues have increased and increased and increased, and it's established itself as the most popular league in world football. It has a dominance in terms of market share, in terms of being the league that the more people around the world prefer to watch above La Liga or Serie A. That is endangered by something that damages the product, and VAR is certainly that. You're having controversy over not only the decisions of the referees, but the decisions of the technology on top of the referees after every round of fixtures. We've just seen the biggest game of the Premier League season, hugely anticipated, hugely floated by the Premier League as something that people should go out of their way to watch. Liverpool against Manchester City, decided via controversy over refereeing decisions, and in particular over VAR's failure to interfere in those refereeing mistakes and remedy them. And none of this is good for football. Therefore, it's no surprise to me that you have clubs asking, why are we continuing with this system? Why do we have a head of the referees telling the public that VAR is working very well, when the public can see for their own eyes that VAR is not working well at all? They don't like it. They're complaining about it. You know, you can't treat your audience like fools and expect the audience to remain and be happy with the product. So I think this is a very interesting moment for English football, and a very interesting moment for refereeing. And I can't think of a time, maybe you can, Ian, but I can't think of a time where I've heard of referees revolting against the senior referee. Remember, Mike Riley is a guy who determines their careers. He chooses their appointments. He decides who gets the biggest game. The reason Michael Oliver got Liverpool Man City is because he's regarded by Mike Riley as being the best referee. He also recommends them to UEFA and FIFA for major Champions League games and for Euro finals and World Cup finals. And remember, there were no English referees at the last World Cup. So if you're a Premier League referee and you're seeing this constellation of events, you're thinking, you know, my career is being affected by the decisions of the man who is my boss.
I think that's correct, Duncan. I've never seen referees openly criticise, and I say openly, there is a code of conduct. I'm cautious to say, a bit like the Cosa Nostra, but it's definitely a vow of omerta, of silence, whereby you don't criticise each other and you don't criticise your boss. And this is all pre-VAR, by the way. You would never, ever get briefings from referees, or very rarely anyway, where a referee would brief someone in the media on or off the record about a colleague or a decision or something that was going on. So it's very, very unusual to see referees break rank and obviously brief people in the media about their the fact that they feel compromised by VAR, that they feel they're being made to look foolish by decisions and implementation of the technology, and they feel that they're the ones who are suffering because their reputation and their authority is being compromised by the way in which VAR is currently working. The fact that Mike Riley seems completely either oblivious or he's just put a brick wall up to any criticism of VAR suggests to me a foolish and ultimately divisive way to deal with it, rather than just meet the problems head on and discuss openly what the problems are and how they might find solutions to them. He seems to be hell-bent on simply saying, we're going to do it our way and you're just going to have to put up with it. And that's why referees are now saying, no, we've had enough. And we're only 12 rounds of matches into a Premier League season. So that in itself is, I think, significant. I think it's just as significant that clubs are going to, or that Riley's been summoned to this meeting, of which is said, you know, a regular thing, but Riley's been summoned. He doesn't normally attend these meetings. He does attend only when he's been asked to. He's been asked to do that in London tomorrow, Thursday that is, and explain how he's going to make it better, explain how what the options are for doing so, et cetera, et cetera. And he will be questioned and grilled on this. Now, I spoke to one director of a Premier League club this week already, and it takes up your point, Duncan, about damaging the brand and the value of the Premier League. The Premier League has a bigger audience worldwide than any other league, including La Liga, which is used to be the biggest terms of audience, obviously because you have South America and Spanish-speaking fans all over the world who enjoy watching La Liga. In the 90s, it was Serie A, which still enjoys a good worldwide audience. But the Premier League is miles ahead, probably twice of both Serie A and La Liga combined in terms of global audience. And this director at a club who is very marketing-minded said to me, can you imagine you're a punter in a bar, sports bar in Kuala Lumpur, and you're watching your favourite team, and to do that, you've had to get up at silly o'clock in the morning. But that's nice because it's a big social occasion. You've of course obviously got supporters clubs in places like Kuala Lumpur, Shanghai, Sydney, etc., etc. But you go there with your mates to enjoy the football, and it's taking 4 minutes to review a VAR check on whether it's a goal or an offside or anything else. You're turned off by that. You're there in the middle of the night, often, to watch a game and see it flow and support your team. But instead, you're being turned off. What do? Do you walk out the bar because you're so annoyed and frustrated by what's going? Do you go to the bar and just have a pint and think, oh, I'm not, you know, what's going to be doing? They do care about that. And I think that's something which Mike Riley and PGMOL have got to consider with regards to if the brand itself is being damaged, not only in the UK, but worldwide, which is probably just as important, if not even more important, in terms of generating revenue. So again, those are three aspects which are very, very significant in what happens with VR going forward. And if, and it is a big if, because it needs a two-thirds majority of the clubs to vote in favour of suspending. If they do that, then that will be a massive slap in the face, both to the technology and to those who advocated it, employed the company, who have supplied the technology and who operate the technology as well. And also puts a real question mark against whether or not they can get it right in the future, whether that's to be sometime to bring in just this season, or more likely, if it is suspended, to return in the 2021 season, claiming that they've resolved everything, which, again, big if, in order that they can produce a consistent, coherent, and credible way of checking decisions via a video assistant referee. The only thing I'm going to add to that, Duncan, is that just before I started talking, we had a siren in the background. I'm not sure if the listeners heard it. I just hope Mike Riley's not sent the VAR police to come and arrest you.
Well, look, why is football popular? One of the reasons is because it's a continuous sport. It's a quick sport. It doesn't have 4-minute breaks in a normal match. And this has always been one of the key issues of where people say, well, video technology works in rugby, video technology works in cricket. It should be able to translate into football. They're different sports. Rugby is a stop-start sport. Cricket is an absolute stop-start sport. So you can get away with having this video intervention between moments of actions easier in rugby and cricket and American football than you can in football itself. And I've also had people on social media telling me they're tired of watching the Premier League because of VAR, which is, I think, you know, I've been on social media for 10 years. I've never had people saying they're tired of watching the Premier League before. This is and the only context I've heard it is because of VAR. You talk about Riley's high-handed attitude. It's interesting because it's almost as though he is taking the way he acted as a referee, which is, my decision is final. I am the arbiter of what is correct on the field, and applying it to something which is far, far more complex and important to the running and the future of the game. So I'm in charge of this. My view in VAR is correct. You will do as I tell you to do. And it's not going to work in these circumstances because, as you've explained, the referees are unhappy. And more importantly, his bosses at the Premier League are becoming increasingly unhappy with it. And look, you've just got to look at the implementation so far. It's classic. This is also classic high-handedness from a former referee and a sort of classic English attitude, which is, we've seen VAR working elsewhere. We'll take the bits we like and we'll try and implement it in a different fashion. So no looking at the monitors, no use of the monitors. Not a single referee has gone to a monitor in the 12 rounds of games during the Premier League implementation of VAR so far. The high bar, which they used for 9 games and then decided to go switch to a low bar, also Premier League intervention. And then this handball law, which caused so many problems, and we discussed in great detail on Monday's podcast, Schrodinger's handball law, as we referred to it, that was brought about by the English authorities being upset for being found out for not implementing the FIFA rules correctly last season, in that they decided unilaterally that any ball that went into the net off an attacker's hand should be given no goal, even though the rules of the game at that point said that it was a fair goal. And it got found out because of the Willy Bolly incident, and people were asking why it hadn't been cancelled, because there were briefings from the Premier League that it should have been cancelled. And then the question was, well, actually, the referee seemed to follow the proper laws of the game, which accidental handball to score a goal is fine. So the Premier League English authorities' response was, we will rewrite the rule and we will petition IFAB, of which the FA has one of the I think it's 8 total votes on a rule change to change the rule. And we got what I think, and what I described on Monday's podcast, as the worst rewrite of a rule we've ever seen, off the back of English football saying, we want handball to change. The conclusion I take from all of this is the people in charge of refereeing in England are not up to the job. They don't think about these things properly. They don't think about repercussions. They are in the habit of saying, we're in charge, we know best, we are going to implement this, and be damned with the rest of you. And what results are messes like we have with VAR, like the mess they made of the most important game of the Premier League season on Sunday.
Well, unremarkably, VAR is not the only controversy dogging English football this week. The altercation between Raheem Sterling and Joe Gomez in the aftermath of that 3-1 win at Anfield for Liverpool resulted in what can only be described in sort of certain terms as a stooshy in the St. George's Park canteen between Raheem Sterling and Joe Gomez, with the aftermath of the result, etc., and the fact that I think Sterling felt, and indeed our information is, that he believed he had been systematically targeted and fouled repetitively by Liverpool players during the match. And the referee did nothing that he felt to protect him. And as a result, the confrontation with Gomez on the pitch, in which he tried to lift Sterling up under his arms and pushed him away, saying, "What are you going to do, little man?" Resulted in Gomez offering his hand to Sterling in said canteen at SGP, to which Sterling, we're told, said, "Oh, so you're still the big man, are you?" There was a bit of a scuffle, so we have been told, and of course it's been well reported, now Sterling has been dropped from Thursday's qualifier. Now, we've had lots of questions on this, but I think an interesting one in terms of what you guys would like to know, and it came from Miss Lumine, and she asks, should Southgate have made more effort to keep the bus stop in-house rather than make a statement and let it go public? Duncan, do you think Southgate's made an error of judgment here? Because let's face it, the kind of general default position of the communication department of any organisation in football, whether it be club or country, is to simply try and hope that it doesn't get out and cover it up. And if it does, then answer the questions later rather than sooner.
I don't think he's made an error of judgment in terms of allowing it to become public. I don't think he had a choice in this matter. I think you're right. If the FA, England National Team's comms group, had thought they could keep this quiet and keep it in-house, then they would have done so. But they would have known that that was impossible with an incident of that type. I don't know how the media first got hold of the story. It wouldn't surprise me if it was someone very close to one of the players involved who had leaked the story. But there are multiple ways. If it happens in the canteen, there's so many people who will have witnessed that incident and so many people who could potentially leak the story. And then it becomes about managing it. And, you know, the FA comms team, I think, are much better than they used to be. They were very intelligent going into the World Cup and in the way they opened themselves up to the print and broadcast media and gave them a lot of access to players and managers, and you know, even arranging darts matches between the players and journalists, you know, famously in the title of our friend Johnny Northcroft's book about the World Cup, he played a head-to-head game against Dele Alli during the tournament that happened.
So we should never turn down the opportunity to mention the fact that Johnny lost.
Yes, well, I mean, I've played darts against Johnny a few times, and I'm not a really good darts player, but I'm sure I have a winning record against Johnny, so I'm not going to credit Dele Alli with any great skill in that victory. But What I will credit the FA for was that attempt to get the media on side, and I think it worked. I think you saw it in the reporting. Obviously, it was a good World Cup for England, so it was easy to have positive reporting about them. But just even going through the tournament, I saw the difference in the kind of openness and sympathy that the media had towards the England team. So, yeah, to answer the question, I don't think this is a choice. I think this is inevitable, and then it's about how you handle it in the best fashion possible. And I guess we'll only see whether he's chosen the right way. And I think it's interesting that he didn't take that decision, Southgate himself. He consulted with the team to ask how they felt Sterling should be punished and how the incident should be handled. But I think we'll see down the line how the relationship is between the two. As for Sterling's complaint, I think he is absolutely justified in his complaint about how that match was refereed. It was clear that he was being targeted by Liverpool. It's no surprise that Jurgen Klopp instructed his players to target Raheem Sterling because of his history at the club and a series of poor performances against Liverpool. So if you're going to play in the mentality of a player, then it was a good option to choose, particularly as he is certainly one of the three most influential players at Manchester City at present. He was repeatedly fouled. I'm just looking at the statistics here, and Michael Oliver only gave two free kicks for fouls against Raheem Sterling in that match, which is remarkable given the number of heavy challenges that went in on him. We saw Trent Alexander-Arnold shoving him into an advertising hoarding after one of those fouls or one of those challenges, which Oliver and his officials did nothing about. It's an intelligent tactic from Klopp's perspective, because if you know the way Michael Oliver referees, it's very much that English, let the game flow, try to avoid booking players at all costs, particularly in these big matches. It's the Mark Clattenburg, Howard Webb, ruin a World Cup final strategy, which is popular because it allows the aggression of the Premier League to be expressed. But I don't think it's good for creative players like Sterling. We saw Sterling fouled in the box by Sadio Mane, with Trent Alexander also going in on him towards the end of the game. No penalty given, both by Oliver and by the VAR. Michael Oliver managed to go through that game without booking a single Liverpool player. I think you can understand Sterling's frustration and how that, when you've had so many refereeing decisions and so many VAR decisions go against you in a game of huge magnitude, that you will be angry at the end. And he saw, you know, Alexander-Arnold move further up the field and Joe Gomez be placed against them, and the first thing Joe Gomez does is foul him. So I'm sympathetic with Sterling on this one, because I think that game was badly refereed, and as a creative player, he was not protected. And I think you've got some more information on Sterling's response to what was happening during the game.
Yeah, I was told by a source at Manchester City that Sterling complained about the continual targeting of him to the coaching staff at halftime, and asked that they go to see Michael Oliver, the referee, and his assistants at halftime and have words, and nothing came of that. And of course, the situation escalated when Gomez came on as a substitute in the second half, and also that there was more words had in the tunnel at full time. I think it's only natural to assume, therefore, that when players were arriving for England training at St George's Park on Monday, that if it was unresolved at that point, which it clearly was, that there was obviously a tension which was palpable and very, very predictably became a confrontation which resulted in ultimately Sterling being dropped for this game on Thursday night. I'm slightly confused by Southgate's thinking on this. I think it's been well reported that Gomez did not want Sterling either to be ejected from the squad nor miss the game. I think he doesn't want to look like the bad guy in this situation. And indeed, he's probably not the bad guy, since it was Sterling who clearly instigated the what happened in the players' eating area. But at the same time, I think Sterling deserves a little bit of leeway from everything you've reported, Duncan, with regards to his treatment in that game and the fact that we know that that was a tactic of Liverpool's to effectively systematically target him throughout the game in order to frustrate him and to stop him from playing his natural attacking style and to obviously create chances and potentially score against them. Sterling, make no bones about it, is one of England's most important players. And I'm not saying that for that reason he should be treated differently in this kind of situation. But in my career, I've heard much, much worse stories about players fighting with each other, causing physical harm, broken cheeks, noses, ribs, etc., because of training ground spats, disagreements after games, etc., players being held by the throat in dressing rooms because they're not pulling their weight. And while I'm not saying I condone any of that, the fact of the matter is it's a very passionate game and people do get wound up by it and fans get wound up by it. And you know, Southgate was a player for many years, and of course he was like is reviewed anyway to be an ambassador of diplomacy with regards to his playing career. But he himself was embroiled in a huge row on the evening before the last game at the Old Wembley, when he was selected by Kevin Keegan to play as a defensive midfielder against Germany. And Paul Ince, who had expected to fulfil that role, confronted Keegan and Southgate and the rest of the squad with regards to the fact that he had been dropped in favour of a de facto centre-half to play in central defensive midfield. And you know, that exploded. And of course, the outcome was Germany won 1-0. Keegan resigned in the toilet, saying he didn't know how to solve those problems. So Southgate's got his own experiences. And maybe, you know, he obviously decided this is the best way to handle it. You know, let's air our dirty linen in public. I've got no problem with that, because it's true. He's in an invidious situation. He knows. And England is a notoriously leaky camp, partly because you've got players from different clubs. So if it was the one club, then it's more likely to stay in-house, because players who leak stuff out would be found out by their teammates. Whereas if it's, you know, as you said, Duncan, there's probably up to 22 or more people in that room when this happens. So players can get away with telling their agents. The agents are going to ring media contacts who will then say, you'll never guess what's just happened, et cetera, et cetera. And it is much more leaky as a result. So I can see Southgate's MO in terms of making a statement on the Monday night, making it public, addressing it again in a press conference, which he wasn't due to do on Tuesday, and then taking questions, but not really answering them. I'm not sure what this will do to Sterling's mentality with regards to how he feels about playing for England. I think he's a very passionate and patriotic young man who wants to play for his country. But despite his apology and his admission of guilt, he may well feel that he's been harshly treated with regards to being dropped from the game. And I think his teammates, and look, you know, I make no bones about this either, in terms of what players feel, they'll think, oh, right, so you're going to deprive us of probably our best player when we still need a point to qualify. So they will go out feeling they're a man short because Southgate decides to publicly castigate Sterling for this, when actually he could, with Gomez's blessing, kept him in the team, kept him, you know, as part of the squad for the game on Thursday night. And that'd be very interesting to see how England play. It's not, obviously, in terms of opposition, it's not the best. So it's, you know, Southgate maybe thinks he can get away with it. But imagine what the furore is going to be if they draw, or, well, they draw, they get a point, but if they lose, what if they lost? It's almost unthinkable, you know, what the outcry will be, because he dropped his best player. in a situation where he could probably have kept him in. So, listen, Southgate has made a stance and he will be damned by it, depending on the result or not. But in terms of how he's handled it, well, that remains to be seen, because there's no doubt he will have to face similar situations in the future. And he's now set a precedent for himself with regards to what punishment he is, feels is relevant to the crime. So we shall see how that goes.
He certainly, it's a calculated risk. You're right. If the result doesn't go with him, he will be criticised for it. And you also make a good point. He set a precedent in terms of how such behaviour will be dealt with inside the camp. I should say I don't condone what Sterling is reported to have done to Joe Gomez, nor do I condone him his apparent stamp or putting his boot on Virgil van Dijk's boot at the end of the Liverpool game, which was picked up by a lot of Liverpool supporters as something that should have been dealt with by the officials in the game. I'm just saying I'm sympathetic to the precursors of that and feel that he was targeted and had right to complain about the way that match was refereed. And I say it's, look, it's typical of English refereeing. You've got the famous Mark Clattenburg Battle of Stamford Bridge when Tottenham were still in with a chance of winning the Premier League title and lost to Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, which ended up with a mass fight of the players on the pitch because Clattenburg had deliberately, and he's on record on this subsequently, avoided taking proper disciplinary action against players because he didn't want to be perceived as the guy who had stopped Tottenham from winning the title. Not only is he on record with that, he did it in an interview in which he was asked to cite the game that he was most proud of in his refereeing career. And he picked that game out as the one that he felt he'd done a great job of, where he deliberately not applied the rules of the game to protect his own reputation. And this was the top referee in English football. And that's the way he perceives the rules of the game and the way you should referee a game of such intensity and importance. And when you take that laissez-faire attitude, which is the Clattenburg, Howard Webb, and has become the Michael Oliver way, you run the risk of injuries and those kind of fights and aggression occurring between players that we saw in the World Cup final that Howard Webb ruined, in that Battle of Stamford Bridge, and which we saw subsequent to the Liverpool-Man City game at Sunday. And the referees, you know, this is something that Mike Riley should really be engaging with and looking at the long-term consequences of that kind of approach to refereeing. But, you know, as we've talked about with VAR, he seems incapable of looking at consequences and will choose some simple approach that he decides is right, regardless of what happens when it's implemented.
Well, we are the Transfer Window podcast, as you all know, and we're looking forward to the fact that there's only 6 weeks until the January window opens and we can get right stuck in, as we say, to all of the news and, of course, the different goings on with regards to who will be buying who and who will be going elsewhere. I'm very pleased to say that along with Jurgen, Pep, etc., etc., we also have another famous listener, and that's Dave Moore of Dave and Dermot on Irish Radio Today FM. And Dave has texted us a very interesting question with regards to Manchester United's intentions in the January window, Duncan. And he says, with Manchester United linked with lots of players in January and approaches, would a senior centre-back be the most important signing they could make? Example, an Evans type, interestingly, because obviously he did leave Manchester United, to improve Maguire, who hasn't played well enough to match his fee yet. Now, obviously, you will disagree with the Maguire thing, Duncan, because you're a big fan and you think that he's played brilliantly. Who do you think could improve hire Maguire if he's playing alongside him? And tell Dave, please, because I think he sounds like a little bit, he needs to be given some assurances and confidence in what's going to happen in the last 5 months of the season.
Well, first of all, I'm surprised that Dave doesn't agree with the English media representations of Harry Maguire as the new Rio Ferdinand and the new Nemanja Vidic rolled into one. I mean, that's what we were told he was after his start to the season. I think Dave makes a very good point. I think the defence is not sorted. They still need a high-quality centre-back to lead the defence, who's not error prone, who's a lot faster than Maguire is. However, I don't see that happening. United have spent their money on Maguire, that record transfer fee, £85 million. They've also spent what was a record fee for a specialist fullback when they bought him, up to £55 million on Aaron Wan-Bissaka. So that there's a huge amount of investment going into the defence from the Glazers' perspective. And of course, the briefing from the club is that they had a brilliant transfer window, that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's guidance on what and who they should recruit was excellent, that they probably don't need the specialist director of football because they have started to solve the problems of recruitment. So the line is very much, we got it right in the summer. We move on to different areas of the team using Solskjaer and others' expertise to reapply those effective and intelligent solutions. And they are looking, as we told you on the podcast before, for a centre forward of a different type to Rashford and Anthony Martial. They've realised that they need a more physical player, someone who's comfortable playing with his back to goal, who can hold the ball up to give themselves tactical options, which is amusing given at the same time their briefing that their transfer window was so successful. The reason they don't have that type of player is they decided on Solskjaer's advice to get rid of Romelu Lukaku, and it has clearly hampered them in this first part of the season with what, just 4 Premier League wins from 12 games, spending a good chunk of the season in the bottom half of the table, their Champions League qualification, which is necessary for commercial purposes and bonuses that they get from their sponsors, in doubt already at this stage of the campaign. But the focus is there, and the focus is in midfield. It's not on centre-back, though I agree. In fact, if in my view, they would probably be better off switching Maguire for that senior centre-back who could do the leadership role, taking a loss on the transfer and getting someone in who actually fits the requirements that they needed and which were identified to them long in advance. The previous manager had told them that they needed to change at centre-back. That, however, is not going to happen. And you can see Harry Maguire is now the captain of Manchester United. So I'm afraid you are stuck with Maguire and his Vidic, Ferdinand, Beckenbauer-like genius for some time to come.
It's interesting, Duncan, that Manchester fans, including Dave, are more concerned about the defence, when the word amongst most agents I'm speaking to at the moment, I'm sure you are too, with regards to what the movement will be in January, is that Manchester United are very much in the market, not just for a striker, but for a wide attacking midfielder who could play on the left, which is odd because Rashford is currently starting on the left with Martial playing through the middle and Dan James playing on the right. But obviously the name of Wilfried Zaha comes up again. And yet again, another ironic, if that were to happen, having bought him from Crystal Palace, then sold him back for a loss, to then buy him for around the market value right now, 70 to 80 million pounds. It just seems, like bad management. There's no way you can describe it as anything else. But it seems that Solskjaer is, for some reason, satisfied with his defensive options, despite the fact they continue to concede goals. So it's very, very bizarre that, when Man United are seen as relatively successful as a counter-attacking team, I think they showed that against Brighton Hove Albion in their win last Sunday, when Brighton decided to take the initiative and go at them, but were caught obviously in a counter-attack and lost the game 3-1, that Solskjaer should be looking to improve his attacking options wide and central, rather than shoring up, which is clearly a leaky defence, and something which, of course, Sir Alex Ferguson, Jose Mourinho, always believed you build a team from the back. Solskjaer, of course, is a striker. Is it? Do you think it's just his mindset that he concentrates more on the attacking form of the team rather than looking at the defence and asking himself, why is it we're conceding so easily and so well, continuously, really, in terms of their last 12 matches?
I don't think so. I think he looked at the team and saw that defence was an area that he had to invest in the summer. And look, there's no argument there. It was obvious the defence wasn't good enough. And you can't argue with the fact that they spent a lot of money on it. You can argue with how they've spent the money. But that was Solskjaer's decision to go for those two players. And Wan-Bissaka, I think, is a good signing. He is, you know, he's a great one-on-one defender who needs to develop to a certain extent his positioning. And you will want to see him being more effective as an attacking fullback. But I think he's capable of both of those. I think his physical attributes are exceptional. And the two elements that he needs to add to the game are elements that can be added, particularly the positional sense. Maguire for me is a mistake, but that was the mistake that Solskjaer decided to make. Then you clearly have this idea from Solskjaer that he wants to attack with pace and wanted quicker players and therefore wanted to dump Romelu Lukaku, which he was allowed to do. And they got a significant transfer fee from Inter for him. But then you see him go to Inter and score at a high rate when he has a manager who believes in him again. And as our friend Christoph Terror explained a couple of weeks ago, they solved a problem with his diet and his digestion that Manchester United had not spotted in the period he was at the club. So, you know, Solskjaer, I think, clearly made an error in thinking that you can have a fast attack and not have an alternative strategy, because it makes it simple for opposition. If you know the way that Manchester United are going to attack, which you do, and you know they only have one way of attacking because they don't have players to bring on to change it around if necessary, then you know how the game's going to be and you can set up for that and you're not going to be caught by surprise. And as you say, I think Brighton, I did put the question to Glenn Murray on last Friday's podcast about whether it would be an error to go after Manchester United in the way that they went after Tottenham so successfully in their recent home game. Unfortunately, they fell into that trap. And United's first goal was fortunate with a couple of deflections. And their second goal shouldn't have been given because there was a handball from Maguire. But it's if you go after United as a team with not as good personnel as Manchester United, and certainly the gap between Brighton's personnel and Manchester United's personnel is probably as close as it's ever been, but United have the better players in the round. If you go after them, you're playing the way Solskjaer wants you to play. Manchester United get the first goal, then they can pick you off in the break. So I think they did make a mistake there. What you have with Manchester United is far, far from being a rounded team, and it will require recruitment for sure of different types of players and successful recruitment to fix some of these problems. And I don't think all the problems will be solved even if they do get the recruitment right, because I don't think Solskjaer is good enough as a coach. I don't think his in-game management is very good. I don't think his handling of players behind the scenes is particularly good, and it's caused significant problems with prominent players. But they certainly have to add a diversity to their squad, which Solskjaer has removed in the last summer window.
Well, one manager who possibly has less problems, although that's debatable, and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer coming up to the January window is Mauricio Pochettino, whose club continued to struggle in the Premier League this season. As you all know, we've reported heavily on the different attitude that the Argentinian has had with regards to his playing staff, his mood being certainly very contrasting to what it was last season, and also doubts amongst his players that he is where he wants to be. And a good question here from King, who is at True Nene, N-E-N-E, who asks, Duncan, will Levy sack Pochettino if the bad results continue till January? And why won't he put his ego aside and use the players in the last contract, i.e. Alderweireld, Eriksen, Vertonghen, because clearly he needs them? Do you think that's the case, Duncan? Is he not playing those players because they're in the last year of the contract? And, of course, this key question, would Daniel Levy do the unthinkable and sack the golden child?
Look, Tottenham have done this before. They have sideline players that they are worried about whether they're going to retain them or they want to sell. I don't think Pochettino's particularly done that this season. I think he doesn't really have a consistent team this season. He's been shifting formation and shifting personnel on a regular basis this season, and it's just not working for him, almost whatever he does. Alderweireld's played a lot of games this season, unlike in past seasons. So, again, Christoph Terror explained to us that Alderweireld put a special effort in over the summer to ensure that his fitness was at the highest level, to give Pochettino no excuses not to play him this campaign, because he, for Alderweireld himself, it's extremely important that he puts himself in the shop window and gets the best contract possible at the end of this season, whether that is a renewal at Tottenham or whether it's at another club. On the key question of Pochettino's future, look, it would suit Pochettino to be sacked, let's face it. He is very much the word coming from around Pochettino is that it is the end of the road for him at Tottenham. He has considered and tried to get out of the club for some period of time now. It never actually happened, but he was very close to becoming Real Madrid coach a year and a half ago. Levy prevented him from going there. All the noises around him are that he is unhappy and he would be ready to leave the club. He has targeted, as we told you in the podcast some while ago, he has targeted the Manchester United job as a very prominent opportunity for him. There is significant interest in Pochettino from Manchester United. He was an individual that they considered before appointing Jose Mourinho. He's an individual that Ed Woodward rates highly and would see as a coup if he could bring him to the club as a manager. So from Pochettino's perspective, you go from your suitors having to pay Tottenham a very large amount of compensation to hire you, to being paid by Tottenham for being sacked and being free to join your suitor for nothing, and therefore have whatever compensation money would have been due to Tottenham rolled into your new contract. Obviously, Daniel Levy wants to avoid having to sack Pochettino. He has been, in some ways, one of his key assets, and there's been a calculation there that they can make significant money from Pochettino when he leaves to go to another club. The interesting thing is, we have the question from the listener. I'm getting the question from people in football. Is Levy ready to dismiss Pochettino? What is going on with Pochettino? People are asking, and people are getting ready to present candidates to Levy, not just as a summer solution, Pochettino leaves at the end of the season, but potentially as an interim solution if he needs to change things around. The league table is telling here, they are far away from the Champions League spot, and we know how important Champions League qualification has been to Daniel Levy, to Tottenham Hotspur for years now. They've run their entire seasons around qualifying for the Champions League, dumping other trophies, so they can focus on getting the Premier League points required in the past to get that Champions League qualification, because it's fundamental to their financial model. So when you get in a situation where that qualification is in question, then the decision that Levy is having to make is, and the calculation he's having to make is, has this got to a point where I have to sacrifice the guy because the players aren't happy and he's not happy, he's not performing the way he can perform. The good thing we've been on for such a long period has come to an end, and a change is required at the top to get the best out of what is a very, very good squad of players. You know, there's no question that Tottenham have a excellent personnel who should be far higher up the Premier League than they are at present. And I think the statistic is the last away win for Tottenham was in January in the Premier League.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's correct.
Which is remarkable for a club with that calibre of player to have gone so long without an away win in domestic competition.
Well, in response to King's question, Duncan, I made a call to a very high-profile agent who has had multiple dealings with Tottenham Hotspur over the years, just to get a little kind of, you know, dip the toe in the water and see if that person had heard anything which might be, let's just say, illuminating regarding Pochettino's situation. Now, while I wasn't given any information with regards to, you know, a concrete idea, would he be sacked or not, what this agent said to me was, well, look, Daniel's clever in these ways. Daniel Levy, of course, that is. Daniel's clever in these ways. If he feels that Pochettino's taken the club as far as he can, and if he gets the real vibe from the manager that he doesn't want to be there and that this cycle of management has come full circle and will not extend, then without losing any money, what you could do is you could put Pochettino on gardening leave without sacking him, in which case Pochettino would be paid his salary on a monthly basis as normal. But there would be, because remember, he signed a new deal, but what there would be a payment to Tottenham at any point when Pochettino was employed by another club. So Pochettino, rather than be sacked and take a payoff, which is a normal, of course, we know, default position when managers leave football clubs, instead, he would be paid his monthly salary with a clause which says, when you take another job, then that club has to buy out your contract for the next 4 years, which would mean, obviously, a substantial payment to Tottenham around between 35 million euros. So clever and practical. And Duncan, you've seen this happen before with Robbie Di Matteo at Chelsea, haven't you?
Well, this the example I would prefer here is Napoli and Maurizio Sarri. That's exactly what Napoli did in order to gain compensation from Chelsea for Sarri, when they knew that they knew Chelsea wanted him as manager, and if it wasn't going to be Chelsea, then it was probably going to be someone else. And they'd also decided that they didn't want Sarri as coach any longer, so he was put on gardening leave. He, in that case, had an interesting release clause in his contract, in that the compensation a club had to pay Napoli for hiring him was far higher than the amount Napoli had to pay Sarri if they sacked him. So they were able to sort of put him in this holding pattern while they negotiated with Chelsea to secure a big compensation deal from them, without having a particularly significant expense involved in if they decided down the line to sack Sarri, having put him on gardening leave, that they'd be able to do that. So I suspect Daniel Levy's paid attention to what happened there. And what would be very interesting to know is whether there is the same asymmetrical release clause in Pochettino's contract, in that he doesn't receive the same amount of compensation if he's sacked as Tottenham would be due if someone else hired him.
I fully suspect that will be the case from experience and dealings. But yeah, that's one to watch out for. Clearly, there are problems at Spurs, which we have talked about, elucidated, and commented upon in recent podcasts. We're going to draw our Wednesday Q&A to a close with, of course, the traditional hurrah of the Donkey Awards. And you'll not be surprised, I hope, to hear that we have decided to dedicate this to the one and only Raheem Sterling, the warrior that is probably about 5'6". And we're going to call it the Raheem Sterling No Fear Award, the way in which he confronted opponents much greater than him in terms of size and weight in Joe Gomez. Duncan, I'm going to open the golden envelope just to find our candidates. There we go. No expense spared, as always, as you all know. And, first on our list of candidates is the man himself, Raheem Sterling, for showing no fear in the way he left Liverpool. I think that's quite a good one, actually. Yeah, he definitely showed no fear. Neither did his agent, as I remember, Duncan. I think on a more humorous note, Eden Hazard has received a nomination for the way he kicked a Swansea City ball boy who he believed was withholding the ball during a League Cup semi-final against Chelsea. If you remember, he got a red card for that. Google it online or any other search engine you prefer, because it's very humorous. And the third one, Duncan, is the GOAT himself, Leo Messi, who charged into an absolute mountain of a man in Maicon during a Champions League semi-final against Internazionale in 2015, put his rather considerably less powerful shoulder into Maicon's head. But all the same, showed no fear in doing so, because Maicon went down and stayed down. And therefore, showing that he's not just Mighty Mouse, as well as skill added. Please give us your deliberations on the candidates and, of course, this week's winner.
Well, Raheem Sterling indeed showed no fear in leaving Liverpool, and hasn't got over the consequences of it yet. He remains persona non grata in that city. But you have
less
to say
than
that
you.
Less than me. Still.
Judging by your timeline over the last 3 days.
Yes, as you pointed out, Liverpool supporters seem somewhat. Have a difficulty in celebrating these key victories and have to take offence at anyone pointing out that there were some strange decisions were made in the fashion in which those key victories or that key victory came about. But I think we're going to exclude Sterling from that, because I think you can see he made the right decision in leaving that club. He has propelled himself to the very top of the English game, and he doesn't have Brendan Rodgers upbraiding him in training sessions anymore, as was and being caught on video being admonished by the great Rodgers. Eden Hazard, I think that's a very strong candidate there. No fear in going in on someone,
a 12-year-old.
Half his size, half his age. I quite like the fact that the ball boy in question hit the training top, the jacket he was wearing as a ball boy, on eBay after that event, and apparently earned £28,600 for selling his jacket on eBay. But
that's even more than Jose's Matalan jacket got.
Is it? How much did the match?
I think I only got about 5.5, to be fair.
Okay, well, there you go.
He's done well. He's a future entrepreneur, that boy. He'd probably buy a football club at some point.
It's not just transfer market inflation we deal with. It's eBay jackets. But I think the winner here is Messi. I've had the pleasure of interviewing Mike on, in fact, just before the Champions League final he won in 2010 in Madrid, and I certainly would not pick a fight with that man. He is a unit, as we say. And Messi, yeah, no fear, and maybe not unconnected with famously the medicine he had to take because of his growth deficiency as a child. He took lots of human growth hormone at that stage, which is something that adds a bit of aggression to a person. So maybe that's helped him in his football career as well, to take on these mad mountains when they go the wrong way against him on the pitch.
Well, there we have it. I think we've managed in some way to create history on today's Your Questions Answered podcast, because I'm pretty sure that's the first time Leo Messi has won a Donkey Award. Now, given that he's got like about 100 Ballon d'Ors and 1,000 trophies besides that, none of them with Argentina, of course, the Donkey must take pride of place in what must be a burgeoning trophy cabinet in the Messi household. Leo, don't worry, we know you're listening. We will send it on to that wonderfully shaped football house you have just outside of Barcelona, and you can put it on show and tell your kids how proud you are that you have been voted this week's Donkey winner.
More importantly then, Ian, we better not tell Cristiano Ronaldo that Leo's got one and he hasn't yet.
Oh no, what have we done? Right, okay, we'll have to have an editorial meeting after this podcast to decide how we can somehow fix a Cristiano Ronaldo winner as well. You didn't hear that, obviously. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your questions, as always. And thank you for keeping the debate going, which has been very, very feisty and lively, as I made reference to in terms of our timelines, giving Trent Alexander-Arnold's non-handball, even though he said it hit me hand in the last 3 days. But please keep the debate going, because you know what it's like. It's all good. We don't mind getting involved with you. We love getting involved with you when you actually sort of, you know, listen. Obviously, some people are a little bit less sort of inclined to take on board that this is a conversation and a debate. But please keep going with it, because we do enjoy getting your tweets. So do that at Transfer Podcast, at Duncan Castles, at Garbo SJ, as you have been doing. As always, not just in the last few days, but over the last 2.5 years. Today's Q&A was a small example of the questions we received. So if you want to continue and ask other questions, then please do so, and we will happily reply, as you know. If you like what you've heard, and we know thousands of you do, you know what to do. Go onto iTunes, give us a 5-star review, and of course, we all get more acquainted. We will be back on Friday for the Transfer Window podcast, and of course we'll have updates from that crucial Premier League meeting that we spoke about at the top of this pod regarding VAR. Until then, we will see you through the Transfer Window. Then, thank you for listening.